Welcome to Clinical Conversations 100 podcast. It comes to you from the halls of Journal Watch, your guide to the most important current clinical literature. You can enter those halls at jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. It's the end of the week, September 10th, 2010. It's the end of the week for some, and for others, it's both the end of the week and the beginning of the new year. So, Happy New Year. This time, we talk about informed consent. Now, don't run away. I'm not going to haul out lawyers and ethicists and start quoting Dietrich Bonhoeffer or Aristotle. This is street-level stuff. To wit, earlier this week, the Annals of Internal Medicine ran a fascinating piece on the disparity between patients' perceptions about the benefits of undergoing percutaneous coronary intervention, PCI, for stable coronary disease, versus those perceptions of their cardiologists. The cardiologists, having studied the COURAGE trial, knew that PCI would alleviate symptoms, but not necessarily, or likely, lead to avoidance of myocardial infarction or cardiovascular-related death. The patients had other ideas. Even though they'd signed consent forms before undergoing catheterization with possible subsequent PCI, they overwhelmingly believed that without PCI, they'd have a greater risk for having an MI within 5 years. And even more strongly, they believed that PCI would prevent an infarction. Enough cardiology. The question before us is this. If the patients were fully informed, why were they so apparently uninformed? The editorialist commenting on the study, Dr. Alicia Fernandez, kindly agreed to take part in our 100th conversation. She's a professor of clinical medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and she holds a professorship from the Arnold P. Gold Foundation. She works out of the Department of Medicine at San Francisco General Hospital, where she's a primary care physician. Welcome, Dr. Fernandez.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I wanted to say right away that I usually don't interview editorialists, but yours was a tour de force of a very practical problem.
Thank you.
I wish that there were more of these things. Let me ask right away, do you think that the disparity between the beliefs of the patients and the physicians is typical in clinical encounters or just in highly technical procedures?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I think it's actually quite typical because there's evidence from other fields that this is the case. Some really interesting studies that have been done in patients undergoing chemotherapy for cancers, for highly metastatic cancers that might be incurable with the chemotherapy, and patients have been told that. And nonetheless, they still believe that the intent of the physician in giving them the chemotherapy, that the physician intended to be palliative for symptom relief, mm-hmm. was actually curative. Mm. So that's been called the quote, therapeutic misconception, in that patients have often overestimate the benefits of the procedure as well as overestimating the risks. And I think that many doctors have that experience with patients when they talk to them about minor things and when they talk to them about major invasive procedures or major choices.
You know, I've been on the other side of some of these consent forms myself and typically the clinician will come into the procedure room and say something like, you know, I see you've signed the consent form. Do you have any questions? And it all seems pretty perfunctory. I mean, what are you going to say? No, I didn't understand anything that I signed.
Right. There's such a huge power differential between patients and physicians. And when patients are undergoing procedures or something like this, they're understandably anxious. They're not at their best. They are trusting their physician to be making good decisions for them. And it's very hard to say, well, actually, there are some things I didn't understand. Mm. But, you know, you point out a very common occurrence, which is that people sign the consent form and then, do you have any questions? Then the discussion occurs. And it's actually supposed to be completely the other way around. Mm. The consent form is not what's important. The discussion is what's important. The consent form, what you sign in the consent form is that you document that, in fact, the discussion occurred. I argue that we need to improve the consent form. But the reason we need to improve it is to not to substitute for the discussion, but to remind the patient and the physician of all the different parts that need to be contained in the discussion. As physicians, we sometimes overemphasize risks. We somehow got the notion through our training that what we're supposed to do in the informed consent is tell the patients, look, you might get an infection, or there might be bleeding, et cetera. In other words, we need to tell the patients the risks. And that was a very good and important message that most physicians of my generation, and certainly younger physicians, have received. What I don't think we've received that clearly is that informed consent is much more than telling the patient about the risks. We also need to tell them about the magnitude and the nature of any possible benefits. We need to tell them about alternatives. And we need to make sure that they understand and accept the magnitude and the nature of the benefits and the risks. And that's where we frequently fall short. So I think that when people read this study, and it was a study done only at one center, so we need to repeat it at other places. But I'm sure that when doctors read this study, they said, yep, no surprise to me. I tell my patients things, and the patients really don't understand it.
Yeah. Well, it was written at a 12th grade, as you pointed out, at a 12th grade reading level, and there was a blanket on the form saying, you know, where you would write in PCI.
That's right.
And I thought, gee, I don't think... That sounded pretty perfunctory. That sounded like one of the definitions of perfunctory. And it made me ask the question, you know, why, and I hope it doesn't sound too militant, but I mean, why are we collecting these things? Are we trying to avoid lawsuits only? And are we just looking, apparently, beyond the patient to a courtroom, and the patient is left uninformed?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think the point of having the informed consent form is to protect the physician, that the patient in fact agreed to the procedure and the patient is signing that they also underwent informed consent and had their questions answered. The problem is in the nature of those conversations and in the context in which they take place. I think we can and should improve the forms, and it's very important to do so. And Washington State actually has legislation that has mandated what an informed consent form should look like. And many hospitals that are not in Washington State have modified their own consent forms so that there's a space for the name of the procedure, the benefits, the risks, the alternatives, and to sign a comprehension. In our hospital, for example, we use there's a part of the form which prompts a physician to have the patient teach back the information, to say, so can you tell me what your understanding is of why we're doing this, and what we expect, that what we hope you will get out of it, and what the risk may be. And then it gives a chance for the patient to say. It also mandates in our form, it prompts us to call an interpreter, which is a professional interpreter, which is very important when working in a diverse patient environment with patients who may not speak English well. But for all of that, it's just a form. And as you point out, you know, it's really easy to sign a form, and it's much harder to ask your doctor the probing questions. Is this procedure really right for me? And that's where I think there's a whole other slew of things that we could be doing.
I would guess that if you were asked to come up with the ideal consent form, it would be the Washington State, something very close to the Washington State, but there are other things that you mentioned in your editorial, for instance, giving the patient some information, giving them perhaps a diagram of what a PCI looks like or something like that.
Absolutely. See, what's interesting about this study which was a very simple study, right? They surveyed the docs, they surveyed the patients, and they found that they really didn't agree on the expected benefits. What's interesting about this is that this is an elective procedure. So it's not that people were under immediate pressure, patients or docs were under immediate pressure to make a decision. In theory, they had probably weeks, if not months, in which to make a decision around using a PCI or using medical therapy to treat the patient's chronic stable angina. And that's the only thing we're talking about here, which is, as an aside, this is PCI for chronic stable angina, not PCI for a treatment of an acute myocardial infarction.
Okay.
So in this stable scenario, why can't we do a better job of giving our patients basic information that would not substitute for the discussion with the doctor, but which would allow the patients to come into that discussion with a much better foundation, and would allow the physician to not have to start from the beginning, but to feel more comfortable that the patient has at least been able to go through this. So you can easily imagine a scenario in which when you make your appointment for a PCI, center or hospital sends you a DVD. This is when your appointment is. Please watch this DVD. Mm-hmm. And in the DVD, information is neutrally presented around what is PCI, what are some of the expected benefits, what are some of the benefits that are not expected, but are proper, but may be assumed to result, such as I'm going to have fewer heart attacks, and what are some of the risks, and this is a what are the alternatives, and this is which is medical therapy in this case, and that's I think could be easily presented, and these are called decision aids. So it's educational material that also, if it's done very well, can help a patient clarify their own options. For example, a patient that has a lot of symptoms may very well prefer PCI because PCI is much more effective at getting rid of those symptoms during the first after the first year after the procedure, whereas medical therapy will provide symptomatic relief, but it usually takes longer. It takes maybe 2 years before it equalizes a symptom relief of PCI.
Let me ask. I apologize for being cynical, but you're putting a lot of burden on the people making these DVDs and the patient receiving them. But I think at that you'd agree that in the clinic, when you're looking into the patient's eyes and saying, do you understand this? Do you have questions?
Right.
That costs time. And in hospitals these days, at least in the current culture, time is, as they say in Spinal Tap, mime is money. There is a lot of, there's a lot of resources expended for this. So if, you know, we would agree, I think, both of us, that it's going to cost time and therefore more money. But what's the upside of aligning the expectations of the patient and the clinician?
I think it makes the conversation easier. Mm-hmm. But I think that you've put your finger on the weak point in this argument. To the extent that as physicians, we are reimbursed for doing the procedure, not for talking to the patient about not doing the procedure, we have an inherent conflict of interest. And to the extent, and it is, that time is money, we are almost disincentivized to spend time making sure that patients fully understand their range of options. Mm-hmm. That's why, at some places and where these decisions have come under a lot of scrutiny, patients. Centers are sort of outsourcing these tasks. For example, in many breast cancer centers, it's not unusual now for patients to be assigned a patient navigator who helps the patient make sure she and her family understand what we're talking about and make sure that the patient feels empowered to and prepared to ask the necessary questions of the physician. Other places, they're actually outsourcing the whole decision making and saying, "Look, you should undergo informed consent and go and talk to this other person, generally a nurse, and then after the informed consent is done, come and see me, and I'll do the procedure." I am not a fan of that. I actually feel that informed consent is the discussion is something that should happen between the physician and the patient. But I can certainly see why centers have gone there, because in an attempt to save the more expensive time of the physician. In the ideal world, as we move forward with comparative effectiveness research, and right now there's a lot of money being put into comparative effectiveness research on the national level, and comparative effectiveness research in terms of figuring out what is better, treatment A versus treatment B. That research, to me, only makes sense is if physicians and patients can then talk about what is better, treatment A for you or treatment B for you. And that's an informed consent discussion. Mm-hmm. And ideally, there will be reform in physician payment, in which we actually get paid to spend time talking with patients and not spend not get paid solely for doing things to patients.
To them.
But obviously, we're a long ways away from that right now.
All right. So we've been talking kind of big system-wide picture here. Let's we have lots of clinicians who listen to this podcast. So let's get down to is a last question. Let me ask you this: if you could have clinicians do something different next week than they were doing this past week, vis-a-vis informed consent, what would you ask them to do?
Oh, that's a great question. Two things. I would say I would have them go to their administrative folks and say, you know what, we need to change our form. Because I need to be prompted. I need to remember, and I want a document that I told a patient about all the aspects of informed consent. I need you to change this form in order to protect me medical legally. I want a better form.
Mm-hmm.
That's easy. That's the low-hanging fruit. If they do the same procedure over and over, you know, PCI, breast cancer surgery, whatever it is, they should talk to their administrators about getting educational material out to the patient before the patient sees them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is that when they're actually having this discussion, they should make sure in their own minds that they have a good understanding of the anticipated benefits and risks, and that they develop a wrap around how to explain that to patients,
mm-hmm.
and then that they check that the patient got it.
Okay.
They check that the patient really understood it. I am sure that the physicians who were involved in this study did not feel great about seeing these results. They didn't. It must not have felt great to them that the patients did not fully understand the proposed benefits of the PCI. And if I were that doctor, I would like to change it, both on a systems level and on a personal level. I would renew my commitment to making sure that people really understood the benefits as well as the risks.
Well, that's great advice, Dr. Fernandez. I want to thank you very much for your time with us today.
No, thank you.
Here's a quick look at the week's most important medical news stories. Roll up your sleeves. The American Academy of Pediatrics is about to recommend that flu shots be mandatory for all healthcare workers. The Academy says that good intentions simply aren't working, so it's time to make rules. Ouch. Next, patients 70 or older with carotid stenosis who are at normal surgical risk should avoid stenting. In a large pre-planned meta-analysis published in Lancet, those 70 or older had risks for stroke or death that were doubled within 4 months of stenting. But with endarterectomy, risks were about the same as those under 70. And speaking of the under 70s, the risks for stroke or death in that group were about equal regardless of the procedure used. Finally, it may seem obvious that intimate partner violence would be associated with postpartum depression. However, psychological violence, such as insults, humiliation, and intimidation, is rarely screened for. The risk for postpartum depression with psychological violence is greater than that associated with physical or sexual violence. The authors of a Lancet commentary on findings from Brazil recommend changing guidelines to include questions about emotional abuse, as well as the more readily perceived physical abuses. Well, that's it for conversation number 100. I'll be back next week with our 101st edition. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this podcast. My email address is jelia, J-E-L-I-A, at jwatch.org. As my grandmother always said, don't be shy. Actually, she said, don't be ashamed, but I knew what she meant. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time, and thanks for listening.